Hi, everyone, and welcome. This is Seek Sustainable Japan. I'm your host, JJ Walsh, in Hiroshima, Japan, joined by the amazing Tristit and Swastika in Futaba, Fukuyama, Fukushima. Is that right? Are you in Futaba now?
We are actually in Namie, which is to the north of Futaba, but pretty close, about 5 kilometers, I'd say.
Oh, wonderful. How's the weather today?
It's actually starting to get much warmer. I went out for a run earlier, and I think today was the first day this year where I could wear a half-sleeve t-shirt. So it's pretty nice.
Oh, nice. Yeah, we had a lovely day in Hiroshima today. Now, for people that don't really know, how long does it take if you're in Tokyo to get up to the area where you are?
So from here, from Tokyo, you would... it would take close to 3.5 to 4 hours to right here in Futaba.
And I visited, I was telling you before we started, that I had a lovely visit up there to the area where you're developing tourism and doing so much wonderful work with the community, regenerative tourism, sustainable tourism. There's so many wonderful ideas that you're doing there. I had visited on a Hope Fukushima tour 10 years after the disaster. And for people that don't know, I think most people do know, but it's often called the triple disaster, right? The earthquake, the tsunami, and then the power plant radiation disaster. But where you are and where you're doing the tourism has really been changing over the last few years since you've been developing tours. And are you seeing a lot of interest, people coming to the area?
Yes, I think lately we're mainly working on inbound tourism. So we try to coordinate with a lot of companies abroad, mainly dealing with school and college related travels. As you mentioned earlier, there was an explosion here, which led to high amounts of radiation, which in turn led to this entire area being evacuated. But slowly we've seen how the evacuation orders are being lifted. With regard to Namie, the first lifting of evacuation orders happened in 2017, and with regard to Futaba in 2022. Mm-hmm. So obviously it doesn't mean that the entire town is safe to live in again, but there's still a lot of places which you can visit as a tourist, a lot of places where you can stay as a resident as well. So I do think that there's a lot of increase in interest, and probably Trishit can share a little bit about the numbers.
But in general, as you may be already aware, that the towns had to evacuate completely. So the populations we are currently dealing with in Futaba is just about 200 people now from an original of 7,000 population. Right now, with the tourism numbers, when we actually really started hosting tourists in 2023, that we started from zero. And we only had about maybe one group in the entire year. But last year, we crossed 400 people from 38 different countries. And because all of this could be possible, because there is an interest in the region, but a lot of people didn't know that you can now actually just take one train up here in the north and you can just visit this area. And you can also be guided around in English and other languages. So I think changes are happening slowly and steadily.
That's great. So most of the tours you're giving, it sounds like, are in English. You said other languages. Are there others working in Japanese doing guiding as well as other languages?
That's right. In Japanese, yes, but additionally also in Korean, because recently, only last month, it's quite a recent development, but we have a new member join us who's from Korea. So now we're able to offer tours in Japanese, English, and Korean. And we're also, because we have close ties with universities in the area, we're also able to ask people to help out if language support is needed with regard to other languages as well.
That makes sense. Both of you studied in Tohoku University, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What were you studying, if you don't mind me asking?
So I was studying chemistry. So I came here right after my high school in India. So I spent from my undergrad years to my PhD studying about proteins and DNA.
And Swastika, what were you studying?
I came to Tohoku in 2019 and I was studying linguistics. I was part of the International Cultural Studies Department at Tohoku University, and I'm currently still enrolled in the PhD course. I'm not completely sure how that's going to go, but still hoping to turn in my thesis and graduate. Let's see.
Good. Good luck. Good luck. You can do it. You can do it.
And you're
working with local travel companies, but neither of you came from like a tourism background, but you've been doing it for a while. And of course, collaborating on the content of the tours, developing the tour locations, for example. How did you get interested? How did you get connected to developing tourism in this area?
Yeah, I think the one word answer to all of this is Mr. Yamane. He is the one person who has been able to pull us into this. So to give a little background about this, it was Yamane-san. He came to, he was born and brought up in Tokyo. And right after the disaster, he realized that the electricity which is supplied to Tokyo came from Fukushima. So that was a turning point for him, where he joined as a reconstruction support worker and was here in Fukushima for a long time, where he also met his current wife. And she is from Futaba. And that was his reason to actually to start to stay in Fukushima for a long time and build his career and family here. And it was only in 2019 that he started this company. And it was at the same time where Yamane-san saw me somewhere in the newspaper, and he reached out, and he was interested in doing inbound tourism, because his idea was that tourism is a peaceful industry and can be a great way for sharing the charms of the region to the world. And I joined in as an intern, and we started developing the first product, that was the Town Story Walking Tour. And when the product was developed, we were doing monitor tours. And the first monitor tour, one of the guests was Swastika. So I think that's where her story starts from.
Is that how you guys met? You were on one of his tours?
I actually met him back in 2019 because he was also studying at Tohoku University. But definitely, I do think that Fukushima and Futaba specifically were very instrumental in molding our relationship.
Wow. Of course, you've also had a wonderful NHK program featuring both of you. How was it making the NHK show together? Was it interesting process? Was it kind of stressful to always be on camera, or how did you feel?
I think it was part interesting and part stressful as well. But we were obviously very excited to receive that offer, because I think that the NHK World Program truly gave us a chance to amplify the voices of the community here in Hamadori, which is something we really want to do, because oftentimes I think that the focus becomes very limited to us as being foreigners in this disaster affected area. But that's not the kind of narrative we want to push forward. We really want stories that have impacted us deeply to reach a wider audience. And I think that NHK World was very open and understanding when we presented this to them. So it wasn't just about us. They went and spoke with the people that we told them about. And that's why I think it turned out to be a program that made us feel very satisfied and very proud of just being part of Fukushima's story.
That's great. And of course, connecting you to such a much wider audience, right? It's a wonderful platform. And then, of course, congratulations for winning the Japan Travel Awards Special Award for community-based, regenerative, special social impact projects. That's wonderful. That's how we met, to meet you there. That was wonderful, too.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
No, fantastic. And then on the website and on the NHK show as well, I think I saw some of these local people who you work with for your tours. Can you introduce these four main people?
Sure. Maybe I'll go ahead and introduce Kimura-san, if that's all right. So I've been interpreting and translating for Kimura-san for, I think, 2.5 years now. And I would say that his story really changed the way I perceive life and perceive my job and my role here in the community in Fukushima as well. So Kimura-san originally hails from Okuma, and he unfortunately lost 3 members of his family to the disaster in 2011, his father and his wife and his daughter, Yuna, who was only an elementary school student at the time. So he does workshops with school students, university students, but he also does these tours of what's called the interim storage facility. This is a special facility that was constructed in the towns of Futaba and Okuma, and it is where the contaminated soil from all over Fukushima is being stored for a stipulated amount of time. But Kimura-san's house is located in this interim storage facility. So he offers tours of this area. He shows us the classroom where his daughter was studying at the time of the disaster, from where she had to evacuate, tells us the story of how she was picked up by her grandfather, and they were trying to go back home so that they could rescue the grandma. But in the event of trying to make all of this happen, she and the grandfather ended up losing their life. So I think it's a story that inspires me to think not only about how we use energy in the world today, but also about how disaster prevention is not something that we need to think about when a disaster happens. I feel like, you know, usually we only end up discussing these things when an earthquake has happened, when a tsunami has happened. These are things that you need to prepare for many, many years in advance. There are things that you need to be discussing and rediscussing, I would say, on a monthly basis, in fact. So I think his story has been very profound and impactful for me.
Absolutely. And in the NHK show, when he tells his story firsthand, and I believe you or Trisit is helping with translation for the group, and that has such a deep impact for the students in the group, of course, you know. And then same in Hiroshima. When I do guiding in Hiroshima, we're telling the stories of survivors that we've talked to, that we've heard their testimony. And there will be a time, I'm sure, where directly you might be leading a group and the person you're talking about might not be able to do it, but you're still playing such an important role to tell that story in person. It's not just a video, right? It's not just something written. You're continuing that tradition of telling the story in person. And I think that has more impact that way. So it's very important work that you're doing, I think. And I appreciate that even though these stories are so difficult for the people to tell about themselves and such traumatic parts of their life, and we have so much gratitude and respect when people are willing to share that deeply sad time of their life with us, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
How about one of the other members of this four?
I can share a little bit about both Mr. Hideza Sato and Nanami Akimoto. And Hideza-san is actually a resident of Nami Town. He was the first person to come back to the town when the evacuation orders were lifted in 2017. And he is, of course, he plays a role as a community leader. And whenever somebody new comes in, you can always go and visit him. He will tell you about the life in Namie, and he has such wonderful stories to share about how he used to run from his school to just go back to his house for this washroom or something. You know, he would he's a very, very friendly person, and I think everybody knows him. And he is very, very instrumental because he has a stunning record of every single day of his life for the last more than 15 years, and he records every single day of his life in his diaries. So I think he has a great knowledge of the region, but also he speaks for the community as a whole too. And of course, Narami-san, she is also a local resident of Tomioka, and she's involved in art and theater. She uses a lot of theater to share the stories of a lot of the houses and a lot of the people who either lost their lives or lost their properties, and she's using a lot of the art forms to share this with everybody. And we actually work with these people to either directly listen to their stories or to develop workshops with them, so that when the listeners are listening to them, they are not just thinking about Fukushima, but they're also actually actually able to reflect about their own lives and their own homes in the process.
I think that makes such a difference, right? When they're not only, we're not in our tours, your tours and our tours in Hiroshima too, you're not just talking about the past, but you're talking about resilience and how people have overcome hurdles and what life is like now. I'm sure that's a big part of your tours, and people's interest is seeing 15 years later, how are people living now? What is the situation now, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
There was one more person in the collaboration team.
That was Yamane-san. I think Trishit already shared briefly about him, but I feel like he is in many ways the driving force, and gives what we do so much purpose. I think that for all the people who you shared earlier, what we really like is that we've been able to build a relationship where we can laugh together now, where we can make jokes. And I think that's what really creates that sense of community. We're not only looking at this region with a lens of pain, with a lens of tragedy, but trying to expand beyond that, creating space for other human emotions and seeing how we can best relay them to our audiences, to people who come visit us here as well.
That's fantastic. It's such, you know, as we have more visitors who are returning to Japan for a second time, they're looking for opportunities which are off the beaten track. And I think tours like yours in Fukushima have so much appeal and so much more meaning for people who want to dive deeper into Japanese culture and hear about stories of the past and present, right? So this is your website, Fukushima Seaside Travel. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about what people can expect, like what kind of tours you offer?
We have been offering a lot of educational tours up until now. We call it a font tour that has been taken from the names of the four towns, Futaba, Okuma, Namie, and Tomioka. So we usually guide student groups, university groups across these four regions. We make sure that they visit a lot of the facilities, but also get to meet a lot of the local people who were either living in this area or have come back to this area and sharing their stories. So we do a lot of custom-made tours, and we have hosted the people from a lot of different countries. But we, at the same time, we also do. We have also been trying to push another tourism, another product called a Sprint, actually, which is very, very reminiscent of the horse motif, because this region has a strong history of horses, especially the Soma Nomai festival is a 1,000-year-old festival with horses. And we also want to share that this region has a history which is also much longer than just a nuclear disaster. They have the samurai culture, they have the agriculture, and they have the people who live much more than just its conversations around energy. So we do this so that anybody can actually join, even if you're not interested in more of academic and tourism. You can actually just come and have a good time. You want to do surfing? Yes, you can do here. You want to see a 2.5-kilometer long sakura tunnel with far less tourists than Tokyo? Then of course you can actually come here. So we also want to show that this region is just as pretty and beautiful as many of the other regions in Japan. To normalize that is also an effort in the revitalization process. So that's what we are trying to achieve.
Yeah, and it really struck me when I visited. I'd never visited Fukushima before, but of course the area of Fukushima is so big. It's such a big prefecture. There is a lot more to offer than just about the disaster, which was a very small affected area. But I think for many, many people, since the Fukushima disaster is so famous, it definitely is a reason people want to experience at least part of that story and learn part of what happened at the disaster, how the people are moving on, how are they living now, as well as get eyes open to all the other beauty and all the other amazing things that they'd never heard of before, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Fukushima is actually Japan's third largest prefecture. I didn't even know that up until I came here, but you're right. It is pretty huge. Yeah.
That's amazing. I remember also when I was looking at the website and this picture of you, swastika, walking through the field and the motto, glimpses of the future found in Futaba. So this future focus, right? Showing pictures of the past and then what it looks like now. So this is kind of a part of the past that's been lost, but what is going forward? What is the new future? Is that kind of the philosophy of a lot of the tours that you're doing?
I think so, to some extent. Well, we try to highlight what happened in the past. Esther was sharing, we try to make sure that the way we look at the past or define the past is not limited only to the disaster. While that is a very, very important portion of Futaba's history, and we want everybody who comes here to know about it, we also want them to know about the kind of festivals, let's say, that would happen here. For instance, Darumaichi, that's one of our favorite festivals, happens every year in January. You can find selling chai. So if you want to have authentic chai, you have to come all the way to Futaba. So we do talk about the past as well from both perspectives, talking about the disaster, about energy in the region, because it's a history that goes, actually, it's not just nuclear energy. There's also coal, there's also thermal energy. So we make sure that we give people glimpses into that. But we talk about the culture, the tradition as well. And then we try to, towards the end of the tour, we try to shift the focus a little bit to the future. So the photograph that you shared earlier that also has a wall mural behind that says, "Don't be afraid to have fun." And that's part of a project called Futaba Art District, undertaken by a wall mural art group called Overalls. And I feel like that's the note that we also like to leave our visitors on, that this is, in that sense, a very serious area, right? You wouldn't really associate words like fun with Futaba or Hamadori in general. But then again, at the same time, we want to say that don't be afraid to have fun. This is also a region where you get to experiment with ideas, unlock the unexplored potential of what we could do from here on, right? Simply in terms of things like diversifying employment opportunities, figuring out how we can make people stay, people who are moving in, right? There's this whole population called Ijusha or immigrants, but how do we sort of create that sense of home for them so that they can also claim this town as their own, and with that sense of ownership, become a part of writing its future story together.
And bring their own culture and their own backgrounds and their own passions into making a new future together. So you mentioned chai, you're doing a chai stall. That was such a charming part of the NHK drama when you make chai and you did cheers. And Tracy said, "We don't do cheers." And you're like, "Yes, we do. Come on." You know, such a cute like glimpse into your normal relationship and your normal culture that you're bringing as new residents of the area. It was lovely.
Yeah, we've received so many opportunities so far to make chai. Of course, there's Darumaichi, but there's, in fact, next month we have something coming up at a restaurant called Panier in Okuma, where we're going to be not just chai, but also making some different Indian curries, although I don't like using the word curry for Indian curries, but we're going to be making some Indian dishes on that day as well. So I feel like in that sense, everybody has really embraced us and they've given a space for for us to be able to express ourselves freely and honestly, which is what I think ultimately creates that meaningful experience of town building.
Absolutely. You mentioned energy, the different kinds of energy. Now, that was one of the things I was really struck by and very interested in, is how you mentioned Yamane-san came to the area understanding that the energy that created this disaster, this power plant problem, was energy going to Tokyo. It wasn't even energy used by locals, but they have the problem, right? And so seeing how many windmills and solar panels and going along the coastline there and seeing the windmills and then the solar panels along the coast and then in the distance, seeing the crippled Fukushima power plant, seeing this contrast of renewable energy and nuclear energy, and it really makes you think about what are our choices in terms of energy. And what is the long-term view of more sustainable energy? And I heard that Fukushima community, they're really going for it with renewable energy and some of the best or most forward-thinking parts of Japan are in that area. So that was really encouraging to see. I also drive an electric car, so it was nice to see an electric car charger even after, you know, 10 years ago, 2021, when I was there. Are you seeing that? Are you seeing more of this kind of attention to, we want to have more renewable energy, we want to have more sustainable type of businesses? There seemed to be a lot of enthusiasm for that when I was there.
Yeah, I think especially with energy, as you mentioned, there's a lot of shift towards renewables. And because, of course, Fukushima as a prefecture has decided not to use nuclear power, and some of the towns have decided that they want to be carbon neutral by 2050, and a lot of proposals for that. But this is also comes with the challenge that a lot of these solar panels, a lot of these wind power still keep on supplying that energy to Tokyo. What connects to the grid, only that has changed from a power plant to the solar panel. So I think a lot of the conversation also, that's where we try to focus on, is just changing into clean energy may not be enough. It's not just about the recycling process, but also the reduction. Why do we consume energy in such a process that we do in today's world? What is convenience? Do we need 24-hour service at every beck and call? We probably don't. And probably rethinking those ideas and what we can do to create more sustainable communities, and not just trying to make a larger, murkier system work in a cleaner way. So I think that is something which there's a lot of conversation which is happening in Fukushima post disaster. And I think because I think the sustainability, that's what we do try to focus on, and that is something which comes more as a byproduct, I would say. It's of course not in a way that we try to think of sustainability actively, but we more so we question what we are doing and how communities should be, how people should be living. And I think just having a conversation such as these and re-questioning a lot of the value system that we have nurtured in today's world makes us more sustainable than a lot of the other places. And that's what I think we are aiming for.
Yeah. Another interesting point I found when I visited, being in Hiroshima, working in tourism, I am always asked, is it safe to live in Hiroshima? Now, I'm sure you are asked that as well. And when I visited that area, I was so impressed by all the testing that had been happening from the community of all the food. And you could scan a QR code and you could see the levels and see how safe it is, and it won't be sold unless it's safe. So I'm sure that's a question that you're asked by many visitors, right?
Yes, that's one of the common questions we come across.
Are you able to show them the QR code and talk about the process of testing food and
Yeah, we're able to talk about that. And we, for some tours, we are also able to carry around dosimeters that help you measure the ambient radiation. So it's not just in certain spots where you have the QR codes, but you can just carry it with you as you walk and you can keep measuring. And you can, for instance, see how different it would be if you try to take it close to the soil. With regard to food as well, a lot of the town halls here, including our town hall in Namie, you can simply take whatever food product you have and you can submit it to them. They will measure the radiation and tell you about it. I think it's a process that takes about 30 minutes, if I'm not mistaken. So they're very open to that. When I moved here in 2023, I remember being worried as well. I'm not a science person either. I told you how my background is very humanities based. So I had my own second thoughts, even though I had been working with the region for 2.5 years already, and I knew how it's completely safe to be here. But despite that, I had those lingering thoughts, you know? And I feel like that's why it becomes so important to address the question of safety thoroughly, to tell people that there's still zones that are branded as difficult to return zones, so they're not safe to enter. But then there are areas like where we are right now, where houses, that are completely safe to enter, where radiation levels will probably be the same as they are in Tokyo right now, even lower maybe. So I think establishing that distinction and not being told about it, but seeing it for yourself is what helps create that mental shift.
Absolutely. I showed pictures of Asby Brown. He was the tour leader. He was part of the SafeCast organization who was putting dosimeters all around Fukushima, but all around Japan to give people information after the disaster. We had no clear information. And so it was a real service to many of us living in Japan, what areas were safe, what areas were getting radiation. And then we also met with local people who were involved in volunteer testing, community-based testing. And then I think I showed this one, which was at the local supermarket, talking about the testing and how much radiation and realizing, well, my food in Hiroshima, our food in Tokyo is not being tested. Like it's actually safer to eat food in Fukushima if you're worried about it, right? So that was a lot of eye-opening experiences going around that area. Also, I think you have connections with the fishing boats. We had a lot of time to communicate with some of the fishing industry, which is such a big part of the local culture. And of course, it was a big issue for them about releasing the wastewater and losing the trust from the community in the fish that they would be catching from that time. But what a beautiful coastline and really interesting culture and festivals all connected to the fishing industry, right?
Yeah, there's so many. In fact, one that we took part in this year was the Hatsuhino Day, where we all gathered at Namie's Michinoeki at, I think, 5 a.m. in the morning. And we were slightly skeptical because, you know, it's 5 a.m. and it's right in the heart of winter, so it's completely dark. But we had almost, I think, 150 people show up, lots of little kids as well. And then we walked to the coast, which is quite a walk, but 4 or 5-ish kilometers, yeah. I'd say. And then we saw the first sunrise of the year together. So there was that. Then you also have a ceremony called Tezomeshiki, which is held on the next day to pray for safety at sea. So I feel like this town has so many sea-related motifs, festivals floating all around, and it's inseparable from the history too.
Absolutely. And then there was, you know, all the beautiful flags of each fishing boat. They have these beautiful, colorful flags, right? And then the story of the rugby pitch and the rugby team and how they use the fishing flags to cheer on the players during the games. And that's, you know, continuing the fishing boat culture, even if they can't continue the fishing boat or industry, right? That they're trying to keep the culture alive. That was really beautiful.
Yeah.
Now, one of the places we visited and I saw is on your itinerary as well, is visiting a school which was in the tsunami zone. And it really struck me. This is my photo here from when I visited. You can see the sun was just going down, and it's going down in front of the school where you can see the ladder was completely ripped off when the tsunami passed by, and how this poster that was in the school showing how the school basically did survive, but the students and the teachers survived because they evacuated. They had to make a very difficult choice. Can you tell us a little bit about what you talk about when you take people to this school?
So when we go to Okedo Elementary School, it's often dubbed as the Miracle School because all the students that were present on the day were able to safely evacuate to this hill called Ohirayama. But what we try to stress on is that it's not really a miracle school, but it is in fact an example of efficient planning and quick judgment, because the earthquake happened at 2:46 p.m. on the 11th of March, and the principal and relevant school authorities decided that everybody was going to evacuate at 2:54 p.m. So there was just a space of 8 minutes, but they had already decided what the next step of action was going to be in those 8 minutes, which really struck me because during this entire process, the tsunami advisories were constantly being changed. I think it started with only about a 2-3 meter wave, kept increasing to 5 and then 10, and what hit was even worse. But they didn't wait to see how these revisions would play out. They decided that they were going to leave immediately. And that's what helped in saving so many lives. So we try to talk about that a little bit. And then we also talk about how marine life was so important for this entire area, and specifically for the Okedo district in Namie, and how that creates a lot of conflicting emotions in the hearts of people who were present in the day, right? Because your life is inseparable from the sea, but the sea is also what took life away from you. So that's another theme that we try to touch upon. And finally, we talk a little bit about why it's important to preserve buildings like these, because obviously from a purely economic, monetary perspective, people sometimes end up thinking, you know, with only a fee of 300 yen, I think that's the fee for the Okedo Elementary School, how do you sustain this? Is this sustainable at all in the long run, right? But despite all of that, there is a choice that the townspeople have made to preserve this building. So why is that choice important? And how do we honor it from here on as well?
I just found it so powerful. These are some of my photos. You can see that they were studying English and their English lesson is on the stairs, so that as they're going up the stairs, they can practice. And anyone who's worked in a school in Japan and taught English classes, you really identify with these little things. And that really struck me. And then the culture at the school of all the kids washing their hands before and after lessons, right? And you can see so many of these school culture connections while you're walking through. And of course, it's a disaster, and it's wonderful that everyone survived, but it's also a wonderful reminder that you need to plan for safety and you can't wait for somebody else. It's like no hero is coming, right? You have to be the hero. It's that idea. But it's so hard. It's so hard to make that judgment call, right? But they did the right thing. But that point, Swastika, you're talking about, they depend on the sea. That's their whole life is depending on the sea. But disasters like this show that you can't underestimate the power of the sea and take it for granted that it might not harm you, that you have to protect yourself too. Those are really powerful. How long do you usually spend with groups when you're going there?
Usually about an hour, I'd say.
Yeah.
Yeah, that really struck me. That's such a powerful place to visit. But really important point, what you're talking about, how sustainable is the tourism if you're depending on such a small fee to cover people's staff expenses, for example. That's something in Hiroshima too. We have the atomic bomb dome, the ruins, the peace park. It's all government funded. They don't want to make the entrance fee for the museum higher than 200 yen per person because they want everybody who wants to go to come. They don't want money to be a reason. Hmm. But how much government funding can you give for, you know, every location? But I really hope in the future this school might get some kind of protection in terms of like UNESCO, World Heritage, or a national treasure in terms of history, that this is something that needs to be preserved for future generations to see, something like that. And that has really helped a lot of our places in Hiroshima as well.
Yeah, exactly. Because I feel like not preserving these places would mean that we have nothing visual, no evidence in that sense to serve as a reminder of what happened. So whether it's the Ukedo Elementary School or whether it's the Kumamachi Elementary School where Kimura-san's daughter Yuna used to study, and it's still in that state, it's still in the state of what it was like at 2:46 p.m. on 11th March. And there are many discussions around why it's important to preserve that building right now. But I feel like what textbooks and papers couldn't teach me about disaster prevention and the 2011 disaster was taught to me very literally when I had a chance to visit these places. So I feel like the emotional impact of it, the physical impact of it, right? Like, what does a tsunami mean? What is the force of a tsunami? Comes across very easily if you have a chance to visit these buildings. And I think that's enough justification to preserve them. But like you said, there's so many complications. I think your point about maybe it being a UNESCO heritage site could help us sustain it for longer.
Yeah, because we had similar discussions. We came to Hiroshima in 96. The A-bomb dome was not UNESCO until 96. And there was still discussions. It's difficult building to look at for survivors. Mm-hmm. So there was a discussion, what do we need it or not? But luckily, there were more people that said, we need it. We need to preserve it. And so I think you doing tours there, bringing people there, them writing about it, that's adding to the vote to keep it, right? And that interest will help preserve it and get it more attention, I hope. Because we know in this day and age of misinformation, once those real places are gone and you only have photos, it will not have the same impact as walking through the actual building, right?
Yeah.
You probably see it when you take people through how affected they are, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the physical space really makes a difference.
Remember Kimura-san sharing about how during one of his tours of the interim storage facility, there was a student who said that I had a chance to visit the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, but that didn't move me as much as looking at this one school moved me. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that's testament to the fact that these buildings, because they're hubs of memory in so many ways, can serve as really, really powerful reminders of what happened.
Absolutely. And I'm sure you hear that all the time from people who do your tours. And hopefully that also encourages you guys to keep doing the good work, fighting the good fight, and telling people about the feedback, telling other local people the feedback that you hear, I'm sure will also encourage them to keep going. One of the people in the NHK show, a local sandwich shop maker that you work with, and how she wanted to come back and make something that people enjoy eating. And then I was happy to see for your tours, she was making a vegan version or a no fish version or a no meat version. So that when you're working with inbound tourism, having that ability to have collaborators who are flexible for different dietary requirements, That's a big deal, right? That's part of the tour. Have you had, besides her case, it sounds like she's a wonderful person to work with. Have you had other success finding other flexible businesses to work with in that way?
Yeah, we have actually been able to do that with in the similar or different ways with a lot of the suppliers, a lot of the people we work with. And of course, it's with restaurants. It's one of the easy way to associate, of course, because when we are working with a lot of these groups, it's not just about placing an order that just don't add meat or just use vegan products, but also trying to talk to them about why people make certain choices to eat, why people choose vegan food or halal food and things like that. So the tourism it's one way to supply that to the market, but it's also one more. The other thing is to also grow together with the local demand itself. We have been able to do it with the other people which are not in the food related, with how we design the talk, how we design the session itself, what is required at this age group, at this point. So we work a lot. And I think a lot of it is also just possible because this area never had a history of tourism as an industry. So everybody is open to new ideas. None of us, including us, are involved in the tourism industry per se. So everybody's open to new ideas to see how they can adapt to the consumers in the market. So I think that just makes things much smoother and flexible.
That's wonderful. I had the chance to meet Jost.
Jost Sensei, yes.
Yes, and talk to him about his interesting farm to table, table to farm project that he's doing in that area. And he was on the show, and that was wonderful to chat with him. So are you seeing other entrepreneurs besides tourism or in connection with tourism or coffee shops or new restaurants and cafes? Are you seeing new enthusiasm coming in with innovation there?
So much, because you mentioned coffee shops. There's one called Alu, A-L-U, that opened in Fataba last year. They recently celebrated their 1 year anniversary. And I feel this way about a lot of inshokten or restaurants that are speckled throughout Hamadori, but especially with regard to this one coffee shop near Fataba Station, I feel like it's completely changed my perception of the landscape surrounding the station. And that's when I realized that, oh, it's just a small physical space, but it completely changes how you look at it. So I'm very grateful that we have, even with regard to Alu, it's a somebody who moved in after the disaster. It's a new immigrant. He's originally from Akita. His name is Ryokun. And the fact that you can get freshly ground coffee beans here, I think is something really, really commendable, especially for this area.
That's fantastic. If there's good coffee, I think that will bring a lot of happy people who are willing to work hard and be caffeinated, right? Now, Swastika, in this photo of the tour for Japan Travel Awards, you're showing pictures as you take people around. Can you tell us just a little bit about the philosophy as you walk people around? On the NHK show, it sounded like you went to a shrine which was renovated and talked with the local priest. If there's places where you can't talk with anyone who's there, it's kind of an empty space. Are you showing photos of what it used to look like in that area?
Mm-hmm, that's right. So we call this tour the Fataba Town Story Tour, and it was originally curated by Yamane-san. He had a chance to interview hundreds of people that were living in evacuation and ask them about what Fataba looked like before 2011. So if you look at Fataba, you'll notice how there's a lot of vacant plots of land. But the reason we show these photographs is to tell people that even inside of these vacant plots of land, we have lots of stories. The photograph that you just showed was a photo of what the fast food store Penguin, the sandwich shop, used to look like before 2011. It's the owner, and she's speaking through a donut, if I'm not wrong. But what we try to do is reiterate that there's a lot of stories here that are not visible. So it's important to listen to them. It's important to lean just a little bit closer and think about the kinds of things, the kinds of people, the kinds of celebrations that used to happen here in Futaba before 2011. So that's sort of the concept of our story, of our tour. I just end up calling it a story because I feel like tourism in its own way is so much about good storytelling, right? It's about trying to transport people to places and to times where they weren't really around. So yeah,
absolutely. It's all about stories. And also listening. Like, good guiding is also about listening to your group and hearing their stories from where they're from and finding ways to connect their stories to the local stories, right? That's a wonderful part of tourism. In the website, there were these pictures as well. What is this area? It looks like cherry blossoms.
Yeah, these are cherry blossoms for sure. I will have to probably look a little larger image, but I think the closest one we have is close to Namie, the place we live. They have a stunning Ukedo River line of cherry blossom trees. We are just seeing the buds now. So I think in a week or so, we'll probably be able to see them in full bloom. So there's a lot of like cherry blossoms across in many of these towns here. And down in Yonomori, for example, you have the 2.5 kilometer long cherry blossom tunnel, actually. And so a lot of people have memories of cherry blossoms while they were here. So we introduce a lot of these places, even on our tours, that this is the place you did hanami, this is the place you walked your dogs, and places like them.
That's wonderful. And then we're just seeing the cherry blossoms start to bloom now. So I always tell people, if you're missing cherry blossoms, just keep going, you know, to different parts of Japan and you will find them as long as you're in the same month. And then this is one of the murals that you take people around. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Beautiful. Is it, and Swastika, you said this was an art project done by one team, or are these all different artists?
It's a team called Overalls. They specialize in wall murals. They've undertaken several projects around Japan, and they've been working on this here in Futaba as well.
Yeah, I was really struck by all those beautiful murals of people's faces, and really, when you're wandering somewhere where the shops and everything and people have moved out, but then you have the faces there of local people. I thought that was a wonderful project. I'm sure people appreciate it when you take people there.
Yeah.
And then very fun to introduce as well, because I think all of them have slightly quirky concepts. So it's good to be, again, I always keep going back to the don't be afraid to have fun mural, but I think it really makes you pause and think. It's not simply a visual representation of what used to be around, but I think it also has bits and pieces of what we want the future to look like. So it's just really, really good storytelling through art, and also an example of how you can use art for revitalization. I hear about how one of the inspirations for this project was how this artist, I'm sorry, I'm not able to recall her name, but she worked on an abandoned shipyard in Netherlands. She completely changed how it looked through art, and that served as inspiration for the group as well, and for the person who invited the group into the region.
And it makes it like so much more accessible as art, because otherwise you will just be hopping around museums to look at art exhibitions. But just to be able to see them on the streets as you walk and being able to understand what it actually means. And even though they are abstracts on the first look, just walking around the town will make you feel that, okay, you understand the reason why it is there. So I think it democratizes the art quite a lot.
Absolutely. And it brings art back to the community, which really it should be there, right? How wonderful. Was there also connections to agriculture I saw in some of the pictures on the website?
Oh, yeah.
Okuma Nexus Farm. Do you want to talk about it a bit, or would you like me to?
Yeah, so this is a strawberry farm, actually, just one town south of Futaba. It's called Nexus Farm Okuma. And we have the head of the farm, Mr. Tokuta Shingo. He's actually from Hokkaido, and he moved. He's here in this picture, actually. And he used to be a chef and used to work with food industry for a long time, but now he grows strawberries. And when we say he grows strawberries, it's not just you plant a strawberry and then just bears fruits, but everything is automated, controlled. Every drop of water and nutrient is actually just controlled through computers and systems and the workers and everything. So it's almost like molecular biology at an extent. And you're able to grow these strawberries here. And now you can actually do strawberry picking here. And they grow these huge strawberries, and they are very famous for growing summer strawberries, because in Japan, strawberries have such a winter and Christmassy image, but that's so different from the other parts of the world. So so there's a lot of agriculture interesting other than strawberries too. There's like kiwi farms, there's tomato farms and tomatoes which have gone into space, literally, are being produced in Hamadori, and there are garlic farmers. And we work a lot with these people, because at the end of the day, farming and agriculture is one way to enhance the value of land traditionally. So these people finding a lot of value in that land, trying to build and trying to create these wonderful ingredients, is always a great story to share.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And of course, travel and eating good food is so important. And there is a lot of wonderful agriculture in that Fukushima area. I remember, I think we visited a tomato farm as well, and we ate some beautiful pasta with the tomatoes that were grown there. And it was just fantastic. I think I found the photo. This is the cherry blossom tunnel, is it?
Yes.
Yonomori in Tomioka. Yeah.
How lovely. When we visited, they took us through this, and they said, of course, you don't see cherry blossoms here now, but you have to come back, mm-hmm. you know, and that's a wonderful way to get people to revisit as well.
Yes.
So we just have a few more minutes. Is there anything we haven't covered that you're looking forward to doing this year, for example, or any festivals coming up you want to introduce to people?
We do have Namie's Cherry Blossom Festival happen on the 10th of April, and it's going to be accompanied by a hanabi or fireworks as well. So it's going to be quite grand, I think. They had it last year, and if I'm not mistaken, that was the first time since the disaster that they were able to reorganize it at this scale. So I'm excited to be, because I couldn't go last year, I'm excited to participate this year. And do we have any?
We have the Soma no Mai.
Oh, of course.
That's the big one in the last weekend of May. And the tickets are already on sale.
Horses? With all the horses?
Yes. Yeah. It's the 1,000-year-old horse festival. So it's wonderful. If you just search on YouTube the video of Soma no Mai, and that's a great entry point. But it's in the last weekend of May. Yeah, that's from the museum, actually, which shows the festival. So that's and the tickets sell very fast. So it's great to always buy them actually ASAP.
Yeah, that museum was fascinating as well that we visited. And
yeah, I'd
love to go back and see everybody in costume and riding horseback. We don't have any equestrian culture really in this area, but that area where you are in Fukushima is so famous for horse riding culture, equestrian culture, right?
Yeah, and also because you mentioned, because you're in Hiroshima, and actually the feudal lord of the Soma clan, the 34th generation, it still continues. He actually moved to Namie, but right until around the disaster, he used to live in Hiroshima and used to have farms there in the prefecture. I don't think it was in the city, but and he's the main figure in this festival. So even though if there's no equestrian culture, there is some relation between the two.
That is interesting. I'll have to investigate that more. I want to find out who that is. Yeah, how fun. Well, thank you both so much for joining the show. It was wonderful to hear your insights. And thank you for all the wonderful work that you're doing there. Not just for as tourism related, of course, that's wonderful, but also just being there and being part of the community and the new future of Fukushima. What you're doing by being there full time is really fabulous. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Ray.
Thank you.
Thanks everyone for joining. And even if you're watching on replay, if you have any questions or comments, for Swastika and Trisit or me, of course, you can write them below and we will be sure to answer. Thanks, everyone. Take care. Have a good day. Thanks, Trisit and Swastika.
Bye.
Bye.